Hey, folks, this is Kevin. On this week's episode, you'll hear Greg Stone.
I was like, who's being a dick? And he goes, well, yeah, me. What are you going to do about it? And I just go, not on my watch.
That and more. But before that, you know, mailing your letters and packages has just gotten a lot easier. Thanks to Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you can mail and ship anything, anywhere, using just your computer and printer. No more trips to the post office. And it's so easy, anyone can do it. You just click, print, and mail. With Stamps.com, you buy and print official U.S. postage right from your desk. They do all the work for you. Stamps.com even gives you a digital scale that automatically calculates exact postage for any letter, any package, any class of mail. And setup is easy, too. In minutes, you'll be printing your very own postage. You'll never have to go to the post office again. We use Stamps.com at Risk and the Story Studio. And right now, you get this special offer when you use our promo code RISK. It's a no-risk trial plus a $110 bonus offer that includes a digital scale and up to $55 free postage. So don't wait. Go to Stamps.com before you do anything else. Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in RISK. That's Stamps.com. Enter RISK. Now here's the show. Hello, kids. This is Risk, the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. I'm Kevin Allison, and this is Hardy's Jet Boy. Wait, what the fuck is this? Hardy's Jet Band. I guess I threw a boy in there for, you know, it's always a good idea to throw a boy in the mix. Now, kids, we're calling today's episode Double Take. These are stories of people who were surprised to discover new sides of themselves or find themselves doing things that kind of opened up new windows for them. And I'm kind of in the midst of a double take of my own right now. I just announced to everyone on Twitter and Facebook that I'm planning on making 2015 a year of health and vitality by giving up pot and alcohol completely. For 2015, and I've already started on it, actually, with these 2 months prior. I'm 3 days into it already. I might do a full-fledged story about it at some point on the podcast, but, you know, I gave up drinking for 9 years and then started up again last February and had a hell of a time. I love, love, love alcohol, but I'll tell you, Risk and the Story Studio are getting busier and busier. I'm going to be 45 next year, and I'm just feeling like I've got to grow up at least a little bit at some point. I don't know how. I don't know how it is I should grow. Am I going to become a little less kinky or more monogamous? Or am I going to become a lot less goofy? Am I going to become, you know, a lot more serious? I don't know. I don't know what it is, but I thought that taking these two vices of mine out of the mix for at least a year would help me to maybe find out how to move into the next half of my life. I already know that my friends who are in Alcoholics Anonymous will not approve of my going about this on my own, in my own way. I know a lot of people say these things should be done only one way. And I also know a lot of Risk fans will be disappointed. People, you know, writing me to say, oh, fuck, we wanted to share a joint with you when you come to town. People will say, does this mean you're going to stop recording your own orgasms and putting them on the podcast? Like this? I I don't know. Who knows what the future holds? But I'll tell you what. You know, Risk fans have gotten into the habit of daring me to do this or that and then share the story. Well, maybe this is the year that I should dare everyone out there to take on something, a project like I'm doing, take on your own, doing something radically unlike what you normally do. And let's see what happens. Now, in just a bit, we're going to hear one heck of a story from Amy Shepherd, who told what you're going to hear at the live show we did in Portland, Oregon recently. But before that, we're going to hear a terrific story from Greg Stone, told at the Risk Live show in New York City. Here he is right now, Greg Stone, with a story we call Not On My Watch.
I am a rage monster. I really don't think we can walk a mile in this city without finding a place where I have flipped out on somebody for some kind of thing that's like, it's all about justice in my head. Like, I've been to a bakery and it's like they've shorted a person and I'm like, you're gonna fucking die for that! Like, I flip out very quick. I say things that are way too extreme. Like, in my head, I'm a living comic book. It's insane. I mean, I was walking with my dog once and, this woman just goes, watch your dog. And I was like, what? And I just hit her with a dog biscuit. Like, I just threw a dog biscuit, hit her right in the face. And she's like, why would you do that? And I was like, I just threw another dog biscuit right in her face. Because I don't think you should be acting that way. Like, I'm a psychopath. Like, I'm teaching people lessons in my life. It's not good. It started a long time ago. I was, I was going to say this is one of the first fights. Well, it's not one of the first. I've been in a million fights because of this psychotic. Like, I'm not like physically, but it's like, I get into people's faces and then they back down because I'm a little bit bigger. Like, you can get away with a lot of that. I was in high school and we went on a snowboarding trip. Now, I grew up in the south end of my town, which was like, you know, very poor. The north end was very rich. South end was poor. So in the snowboarding trip, I only knew one kid who I went to high school with. So his name was Chris. He's a physics teacher now. So you can imagine what he looked like in high school. Okay, just to give you an example of what kind of body he had. He's the only kid I knew. He was in the front of the bus. They put me in the back of the bus with a separate school. So we just had this other school coming with us. It was Cherry Hill, New Jersey. I didn't know any of these kids. I'm sitting next to this girl. I didn't know anybody there. So I was just kind of freaking out. It's kind of because Kevin was kind of in this story because they made us watch Scarface over and over. But I brought a video, I brought a VHS of The State, and it was like, I had every episode. So we put it on. I was like, hey, we're going to watch The State. They were just, people were like, put Scarface back on. Like, people were like, just like, we watched Scarface four times in a row from New Jersey to this mountain. And I was like, it was psychotic. So I'm sitting next to this girl, and she's overweight. She was a big girl, and there was something very cute about her. Like, she was really cute, and she was sweet. She was eating, like, a full box of Twix, and she had, like, the wrappers all over her. But I was like, you know, when we were in high school, she didn't become herself yet. But she was cute, and she was nice. And I'm talking to her a little bit, and we're watching The State, and she's like, I love this show. I'm not kissing his ass, but it's part of the story. And then the people in the back of the bus start hitting her with spitballs. Now, like, in my head, I'm like, WWCAD, what would Captain America do? He's not going to stand for this shit. So I'm like, I'm going to say something. Now, my mom was always like, if there's ever a bully, get in their face. Say something. They'll back down. That's bullshit. That is not a thing. Okay, these people will fight you. They're animals. So I stand up, and I'm like, who's being the dick? Now, to give you an example of what my body type was, I was a very, very good, aggressive inline skater. Okay, so that's the kind of I'm working with. You know, just you don't want to fuck with a guy who's got, you know, eight wheels on at all times. It's like working with ankle weights. So I stand up, and I'm like, you know, like, who's being the dick? And this guy stands up. Now, his name was Guy. If your name is Guy, you're a dick. That's just a fact, okay? If your parents raised you to be an asshole. It's like naming your kid Napoleon. It's like, we want you to be a fucking prick, so we're going to name you Guy. And he lived up to it. Like, he was a complete asshole. stands up, and I'm like, you know, like, I'm like, I don't know what I'm gonna do, because this guy is outweighing me. He's been trained, but he's like a wrestler, so like, he's going to like wrestling practice. He knows how to do things. I just have four corn CDs that are amping me up. Like, that's my go-to. I have my chain wallet. I'm the Adidas. I'm like, yeah, all day I dream about sex. I don't know. I'm still kind of young, you know, whatever. I was like, who's being the dick? And he goes, well, yeah, me. What are you going to do about it? And I just go, not on my watch. Which isn't even the right time to say that in the fight. Like, I should have gotten up and been like, not on my watch. But he was like, what are you going to do? I was like, not on my watch. See you later. And I should have just left. Like, I'm not going to do anything. But I was like, not on my watch. And he goes to make a move, kind of. And I grab the two railings on the side of the bus, lift my body up, kick him with both legs. He grabs my pants, pulls my pants and sneakers off. I fall on the ground in tighty whities. You know, in like, you know, ninth grade, you didn't get into boxers or boxer briefs yet. Like, I was still like classic tighty whities. I probably wore for 4 days straight. Who knows? I'm all fucked up in my head. I'm on the ground, and he starts trying. Their whole school is holding me down. I'm kind of like weaving around, and he's trying to punch me. And I look up, and I'm like, "Well, this is where I die. Like, this is how I'm going to die. This is the end of the story. This is the end of Greg Stone. But that's fine. We had a great run. You know, you kicked that principal in third grade. That was a fun thing. Yeah, I kicked a principal. Yeah, fight started in second grade, and I broke the fight up. And they were like, you're suspended because you had to do it this. And I was like, no, I'm not. I stand on the legs of justice. That's what I said in second grade to my principal, who then tried to carry me out of the gym class. I kicked him in the crotch, called him an old fart man, which in second grade, that's like saying the N-word. Like, that's pretty big. That's a big insult to, like, in your second grade. My mom picked me up, and she was like, you got to relax. You can't do that kind of shit.
Relax.
So I'm back. I'm on the floor of the bus. He's got his fist in the air, and I'm like, well, I'm going to die. And I just hear, not today, motherfucker! And like a flying squirrel, my friend Chris jumps from the front of the bus, lands on this guy's arm. His whole body was on this guy's arm, and he's just like trying to swat him off. Using physics somehow, he wrestles him to the ground. He's like, E equals shoulder block, and wrestles him to the ground. Fight breaks up. The teachers break the whole thing up. I sit down. I'm sitting in the chair, no pants, next to this big girl who looks at me. She goes, you didn't have to do that. And I looked at her and I said, a pretty woman like you should never be treated like that. I was like, I'm like a fucking psychopath. Who talks like that? Who talks like that? And then I just started making out with her. Like, I was just like... I'm doing this. We're doing the whole thing. We're doing the whole story. This is your night, baby. This is your night. And I don't even know if she wanted it. Like, it was just kind of, that's where I learned that if you kiss anybody, like 80% of the time, they'll probably just go with it unless you're a complete freak. So I just started making out with this girl. She, in a turn of romance, takes off her hoodie and now is just in her bra. So I'm in my underwear. She's in her bra. I put on her hoodie, like, that's how big she was. Like, I put my leg, had a crotch hole, and, like, it was still, like, giant sweatpants. And I sat there in this Kid Dynamite sweater. She came over. The teachers were flipping out. They're like, she's got to put her shirt on. And she's like, I'm not putting anything. He's got to be in his underwear. They gave everybody a bunch of towels and shit. And then we made out the entire weekend, just because we were like in a hotel for like this, you know, this thing. And I would just knock on her door and I was like, are we going to lunch? Are we doing lunch? And she was like, eh, and we did. And it was weird because I wasn't even into her. I just wanted her to have that story, which is crazy. It's just crazy talk. And that's the end of the story.
Thank you guys so much.
I'm coming to get you.
Who's the man? Who's the man?
Fuck with me, and we'll see who shits on the sidewalk.
I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum.
Go ahead. Make my day.
Shit just got real.
Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.
Not on my watch.
So there is this video footage of me at age 15. In the video, I am scrunched up in the corner of this dirty, sagging, brown corduroy couch. There are PBR cans strewn all around the floor around me, and a crappy coffee table with a dirty ashtray that reads Mr. Z's Casino. My friend Andrew is pointing a video camera at me and says, "Yo, Amy, Crust needs something. He needs a boner." In the film, I kind of give this impish smile and I just look like a sassy teenager from the early 2000s. But in my head, I was pretty terrified and my heart was in my throat because I had a good idea of what was coming. Andrew gets to the point and says, "Amy, would you give Crust a hand job?" Now, let's back up a little bit. As a kid, I was always kind of a hypersexualized being. I've been masturbating ever since I can remember. I had my first orgasm at the age of 10 and lost my virginity at age 14. When I got into puberty and started trying to explore sexually, the current group of best friends I had started telling me that I was looking and acting slutty. Now, I mean, this wasn't really that much of a big deal because I'd kind of used to being the friend who, whatever friend group I was in, I was always kind of on the fringe of that group. I was always a little too loud, a little too sensitive, just in general, a little too weird. And so this was no really big surprise as I wanted to explore myself sexually and, you know, it just wasn't going my way. So I figure they're slut-shaming me, to hell with them, and I begin the search once again for that place and the people with whom I will finally belong. And that search leads me to Jessie. Now, Jessie was kind of my social idol growing up. I mean, she was beautiful and talented and desired and, most importantly, just accepted by everybody, no matter what she did. And I figured, well, if I start hanging out with her more, maybe some of that little magic will rub off on me, or at least I'll learn a thing or two. And through her, I meet the aforementioned and handjob-requested Crust. So Jessie begins dating this guy named Jake in our freshman year of high school. And I start hanging out with the two of them and all of Jake's wonderfully punk guy friends. Now, the group of the guy friends consisted of four main people. There was Andrew, who was kind of the leader of the group and had this kind of Sid Vicious thing going on. There was Sean, who was the traditionally handsome but quiet one. There was Alex, who was short but charismatic and looked like what my mom described as what a quadling, which is a race from the Wizard of Oz books, would look like if they were real people. And finally, Alex's older brother, Dustin, who everyone referred to by his nickname, Crust. So Andrew and Crust live in this college campus apartment, which at my naive of age of 15 seemed really impressive. It was to be my beer-stained safe haven where I could fit in and explore myself sexually without any fear of judgment. The place was actually a complete shithole and was actually very well known for the occurrences of date rape that often took place at the parties held within. So, of course, it's where I wanted to spend my entire summer! So, there we are, sitting in the apartment, all the guys just staring at me, awaiting my response. Now, in truth, I had absolutely no desire to give Crust a handjob because out of all the guys there, he was the one I was least attracted to. But at the same time, I so wanted that this place, this group of people would finally be the one that I would fit in with, and I knew that my in had suddenly presented itself. Plus, it was a bonus for Andrew to size me up and to give Crust a rare treat because he didn't get a lot of action from the ladies. As my sexuality is my ticket into this place, I shrug my shoulders nonchalantly and say, "Sure, whatever." Crust and I go into his room and close the door. Now, the first thing that I notice is that Crust's room is wallpapered from ceiling to floor with porn centerfolds. And, I mean, that's not so weird in itself. He's a college guy. Like, whatever. It's not that big of a deal. But the thing that does weird me out is there are those, you know those thumbtacks that are rainbow colored? they're sticking all over, but not just in the corners of the centerfolds. They are like through the ladies' eyes and right through their clitoris. Just everywhere. The worst one, there's this woman who's like spread eagle, but her whole twat is filled with colored thumbtacks, so it looks like her vagina is a home for rainbow-colored bees. Nasty. So I try to ignore this, and I refocus back on Crest, and he doesn't say much, but he lays down on the bed, so his back is on the bed, and his feet are still planted on the ground, and he a little nervously slips off his shorts, and I come over to him, and I perch right on the edge of the bed, and I slowly reach out my hand and grab a hold of his cock. Now, to be completely honest, the handjob that I started giving him at first was fucking awful. Like, it was like I was a robot. I was kind of like... It was nothing that I would imagine you would want a handjob to be. But after a few minutes, I start to relax. And despite myself, I actually kind of enjoy myself because I'm watching him enjoying it. And I have this thought, and I think, you know what? If my sexual activity is going to be my ticket in, I better damn well make sure I'm doing a good job at this. And so I start giving him the best hand job that I know how to do. I'm doing like the long and slow strokes and some fast stuff and that really wonderful like twisty thing that like guys seem to really love. And he's getting into it and he's breathing heavy and just really enjoying it. And then boom, he comes. Success. So I get up, I go and wash my hands, and he puts his shorts back on. We rendezvous in the living room and we get drunk on PBR all night. After that, I was pretty much in the group. And through that, you know, even though I never gave Crust another hand job, I never even gave him a kiss on the cheek again, but I started to get to know him a lot more as a person. And I also started to see a lot of the ways that people in that house, especially Andrew, kind of took advantage of him. So Crest was Alex's older brother by 3 years, and he had, I think, a learning disability. And I never knew what it was. I never asked. I was always kind of too shy and politically correct to ask, but I knew, and I mean, everybody knew that, well, Crest was a little slow. And I mean, it all started out innocently enough. I mean, for example, there was the hand job, which was clearly arranged out of pity. Second, they, you know, got drunk one night and convinced him to shave off his eyebrows. So he had to go to his job at McDonald's the next day wearing that awful maroon little visor with no eyebrows. Then they bought him this neon green fleshlight, which they nicknamed Crustine. And I'm sure... And I mean, I'm sure he used it, but mostly it was used as a tool for embarrassment, which the other guys would take out and chase the girls who hung out at that apartment around with, threatening to rub Crust's dried semen on us. But I mean, the big one came a few months later, when Andrew had the brilliant idea that he offered to buy Crust a hooker if Crust agreed to, every once in a while, when people were getting drunk and partying at the house, to lay in the bathtub and let people urinate on him. And I mean, this starts happening. All good fun, right? Ha ha ha. And I never really saw any of the instances except one. And it was this girl I knew from high school, and it was later in the summer, and she had been coming around a lot more. And I remember her very distinctly. She had kind of one foot in the soap dish, one hand braced on the shower wall, another foot on the lip of the tub, and a beer in her hand. She was completely naked from the waist down. Her t-shirt was still on. And she was just rocking back and forth and laughing. Laughing like she could barely contain her glee. She could barely breathe for laughing. And Crust is just lying in the bathtub, scrunched up like this as her urine just pelts him in the face. And it's getting in his ears and his nose. They didn't even give him fucking goggles or nose plugs. And he's just lying there. And it's just happening. So the summer goes on, and I kind of start hanging out at that apartment less and less. And I remember my last night there was in early September. We'd all been hanging out, and I mean, things have been getting steadily worse at the apartment for a long time now. There's a lot of harder drugs being used, just weirder shit that's going on, but, you know, I chose to ignore it. So we're all hanging out, and then suddenly every one of my guy friends just drifts away, and they all go into different rooms and start shacking up with other girls who had slowly started hanging out there as well, until I was alone by myself, sitting on this mildewy carpet in the hallway drinking a beer. And I just remember being so angry and so hurt. And most of all, I was mad at myself because I didn't fucking see this coming. Or if I did, I completely blatantly ignored it. I was old news. I had given my sexual proclivity and, you know, they had their fun with it and then they were done. I was yesterday's news. And, you know, it just got to the point where I was just... Ooh, I was so pissed off. And so I'm sitting there on the carpet. And I mean, I know what you're thinking. Most of you were like, well, why don't you just fucking leave? Why don't you go home? I mean, part of me wanted to. I was like, I should just get out of here. Just go fuck these guys. They're assholes. But then there was this little tiny voice in my head that said, just be patient. Just wait a little longer. And maybe they'll come out. They'll remember that you're still here. And they'll still want you. Crest comes home from work, and he sees me sitting on the carpet drinking a beer by myself. And he sits down with me, and we start to talk. And we talk long, long into the night for hours. And he's the last person that I ever see in that apartment. Eventually, we all kind of go our separate ways. I graduate high school as well as everybody else, and we go on to do our own things. But we all get back together from time to time, like it's summer holidays or Christmas break, and, you know, see each other and catch up. And the one person who I usually always see when I go home is Crust. But this isn't such a great thing because he was just kind of stuck in our hometown. He just couldn't get out. And every time I saw him, it seemed like he was just more and more depressed. And I mean, I felt for the guy, but I had other problems to worry about. I was in college, and I had my own life now. So, cut now to 7 years later, and I am in graduate school in England, and it's a spring day, and instead of working on my dissertation research, I am perusing Facebook. And I come upon Alex's Facebook feed, Crust's younger brother, and he has posted this really cryptic status update that something really bad has happened involving Crust. And so I am him, and I say, hey, what's going on? And he says that he doesn't want to talk about it over chat, but it's serious. So I say, okay, well, you know, keep me in the loop. Let me know what's going on. A few weeks go by, and I haven't heard anything, and then Jacob posts again. And this time, it's a photo of Crust in a hospital bed with bandages just all over him, saying that he just came out of a coma. A couple months go by. I haven't heard anything, and Facebook lets me know that it's Crest's birthday, which I kind of knew already because we both have summer birthdays. And I post happy birthday on his Facebook wall, not really expecting a response, but about 3 days later, I get one. We start talking, and he says that, you know, when I come home, if I would come visit him. And so it's fall, and I'm back, and I'm driving to go see him at the rehabilitation home that he now lives at. And he lives at this rehabilitation home now because in that spring of that past year, just after Jacob had posted his status, Crest had tried to kill himself by shooting himself in the face with a shotgun. I get to the group home, and I park my car, and I call him to come meet me and show me where I can get in. And he comes out. And, you know, it's funny. The first thing I notice is not the way he looks. It's just that he's not Crust anymore. He isn't this caricature of this punk party kid that I grew up with. He's just Dustin. And he's wearing this light blue polo shirt and these khaki pants and brown shoes. And his hair, which when I knew him was in, like, double mohawks, is now just a regular short length that's just brown. And I go up to him, and I hug him, and I pull back, and I get a good look at his face. And he doesn't have a nose anymore. That where his nose was is kind of this black hole, and there's this little piece of cartilage or bone that, you know, kind of pokes out and kind of looks constantly wet. His upper lip and where his nose used to be had kind of blended together in scar tissue, and his lower lip is kind of bent down and pulled to the side. And he now has to carry a towel around on his shoulder because he can't control the amount of saliva that comes out of his mouth. So he wants to take me inside and introduce me to some people and some of the people he's friends with in the group home. So we go in and we start going around and getting the introductions made. And I mean, all these people are really wonderful and really nice. I mean, it was mostly men who were living in that group home, and they're all ribbing Justin and cackling and saying things like, man, who's your girlfriend? And things like that. But it's not in a mean or malicious way. Like, he's kind of giggling, like, oh yeah, haha. you can tell that, you know, it's intended to be friendly. So we decide that we're both hungry, and we end up going to the McDonald's just down the street because Dustin has these coupons for free cheeseburgers. So we walk in, we get our food, and we get a couple of looks, and then we go and we sit down, and we just start to talk. And, I mean, the first thing we talk about is we kind of rehash all the good old days and relive all those memories and talk about where everybody is now and what everyone's doing. And, you know, once we've exhausted that topic, Dustin asks me if I want to know about his accident. And I hadn't asked at this point, but I said that if he wanted to talk, that I would listen. He told me that about 6 months previous to this, he'd actually been really happy. I mean, he had finally gotten out of our hometown. He had moved to a town about maybe 2 hours away, and he had gotten a job fixing up boats, which he actually found he had a real knack for. And he had a long-term girlfriend, which was such a milestone for him, and he was so happy. But as the way things usually go, you know, things change. And eventually, he and his girlfriend break up, and his depression triggers again, and he starts to spiral down. And he said that he had started thinking a lot about suicide and just wanting to kill himself. And randomly, he also mentions that he was listening to a lot of Hank Williams Jr. at the time. He said that one night, after he had decided that's what he wanted to do, he calls his now ex-girlfriend and tells her that he is going to kill himself. And during their conversation, she manages to put the phone on hold for a moment, which he later finds out to be her calling the cops. They get back on the phone. He hangs up with her. He gets up. He goes to the bathroom. He sits down, puts the gun to his head, and pulls the trigger. Now, the only reason why he didn't bleed out and die immediately was because the cops were right outside the door when the gun went off. They were outside about to knock when they heard the blast. They kicked down the door. They run in, and they managed to stabilize him and take him to the hospital where his long road to recovery begins. And he told me that he really wanted to tell me specifically about this experience of his because he knew that I, of all people, would understand. Because that night, that last night, I had spent in the apartment with him, and when we had talked for so long, I had kind of opened up to him and talked a lot about my struggles with my own emotions and my own suicidal thoughts and attempts. And, you know, there's a lot of things in our culture and our media right now. It's very hard, and people say, you know, suicide is so selfish and it's such a cowardly thing. And, I mean, part of it, yes, is a desire to just be released from that pain that's just this constant ache that you always feel. But I think that there's a thing that people don't talk a lot about. It's that when you get to that point, you convince yourself that all the people around you, even the people who love you and would never want you to hurt yourself, that they just don't understand how much better and happier they would be if you just weren't there anymore. So our time comes to a close, and Crest asked me one last question. And he asks me about the hand job I had given him oh so long ago. And he asks me if I had done it because I really liked him or if I had only done it because Andrew had asked me to. And I had to think about this because my first instinct was to lie to him. My first instinct was to say, oh no, I really did like you, but you know things and they just got in the way. But that wasn't true. And I didn't say that because this other thought popped into my head, and I thought that if I tell him what he wants to hear, won't I just be taking advantage of him like I've seen so many other people do? Won't I just be peeing on him, but in a different way? And so this time I look at him and I say, no, I've never thought of you as anything more than a friend. Thank you.
somebody else. So don't worry yourself, worry yourself. The devil's right there in the details. You don't wanna hurt yourself, hurt yourself. Don't look into your clothes. Too closely. No, 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 no.
This is Risk. This is Fink behind me now. And in a little bit, we're going to hear from a very dear friend of mine going way back. Ben Grant is a fellow member of the State Sketch Comedy Group. We just did a reunion, all 11 of us, for Jack Black's Festival Supreme in Los Angeles. But Ben is seriously one of the most remarkable artists I've ever known. He wrote so many sketches, so many amazing sketches every day that we were together in the state. He's written so many movies, like Night at the Museum, shows like Reno 911. Just a remarkable source of creativity. And I think you're going to be blown away by this story he told at the Risk Live show in Los Angeles that happens every fourth Thursday at the Nerd Melt Theater there. But before we get to that, a story from the one-of-a-kind writer, comedian, performer, Christina Wong, someone who is just as smart as she is hilarious. Here she is at the Nerd Melt Theater in Los Angeles with a story we call The Whiteness of the Whale.
And I could be wrong about anybody else. So don't kid yourself, kid yourself. It's you right there in the mirror. And you don't want to hurt yourself. Looking too close.
Hello. So I have a habit that I don't know if anyone else shares, but I keep really detailed spreadsheets of everybody I ever dated from the internet since like 2005. I also keep a list, detailed list of everyone I've ever been intimate with. And these lists, it's in the dozens, it's not yet in the hundreds, but it's in the dozens. It sort of reads like a who's who of bad credit scores. My friends tell me that my vagina is like a soup kitchen and I am like the Mother Teresa of pussy. I'm just sort of like, bad credit, no problem, come date me. But I make theater for a living, actually. I tour one-woman shows to colleges around the country. I don't really make money doing that here, but I live here. And I think being an artist, or maybe just being in L.A., sort of pulls in the bottom feeders of the dating pool. Maybe L.A. is the bottom feeder of the dating... Yes, one person. Yeah, dating pool. But I work a home alone at a home office, and it can be really depressing. And so online dating for me guarantees that for at least 2 hours, I have to get out of my house and interface live with a human being. So I was on OkCupid a few years ago, which if you're familiar with it, it is sort of like the porta potty of internet dating sites. It's free. Everyone's been in there. Everyone's shit is in there. Yes. And I, late one night, in my deep depression, I get a message from Richard. And Richard is someone I would normally not reply to because he has one photo uploaded. It's blurry. It's uploaded sideways. He's a couple years too old for me, out of my age range at 44. But he messages me and I write back because he says, you know, I've been perusing. This is sort of my hook, line, and sinker thing for guys, if you want to know. It's I've been on this site and yours is more interesting than anything I've seen on this site. And so feeling like I've won this contest,
makes me reply. And we actually go back and forth. And he's talking about things like feminism and meeting Gloria Allred and Gloria Steinem. And he's talking about Miles Davis and Spalding Gray, who, if you are in theater like I am, this is, it's so amazing because it's like I don't have to explain what it is I do for a living. And it's like we are almost sort of like reading each other's minds. And we decide to move the conversation to email. We take it to that next level. And all I know about Richard is that he lives in Hollywood and he just sort of describes himself as a cliche musician photographer type. So we're emailing over a few days, and what is kind of interesting is that he's pretty reluctant in terms of revealing his personal information. Like he's only said he's Richard. I've Googled his Yahoo email address. I can't find anything on him. My domain name, my email address has my domain name in it, and so it's totally like stalker's paradise. You can totally like find everything he wants about me. We're emailing. I'm actually at my friends Mike and Nancy's place. They're married, and me and Mike are working on this film together, and I'm supposed to be working on the film, but really I'm like, you know, trolling for ass on the internet on the side. And I ask Richard, I say, you know, you have all this information on me. Why don't I have something like, you know, your last name? And he writes back and says, well, my last name, it's sort of waspy and plain. It's Hall. Sort of like a Johnson or Smith, I'm a Hall. So, of course, I take that information, Richard Hall, and I Google Richard Hall photographer. And the fourth finding in Google is for Richard Melville Hall, otherwise known by his stage name, Moby. And everything lines up from all these weird details about having just moved from New York. He'd actually sent me pictures of his photography, which were of crowds. And I don't even confer with Mike and Nancy, who I'm in their house with. I just write back right away, holy shit, are you Moby? And he writes back, yeah, I was trying to figure out how to break this information to you. I am Moby. And to prove that it wasn't like a catfish situation, he says, I'm going to put this on my Twitter feed in about 15 minutes. And he sends me like this tweet. And lo and behold, it shows up on his Twitter feed in 15 minutes. And then we start to email at his Moby.com email address. And I can't hold it in any longer at Mike and Nancy's place. And I jump up from the computer and I start screaming, holy shit, I just met Moby on OK Cupid. I am going to be rich. I'm going to be rich. I'm going to be rich. I'm going to marry Moby. I'm going to marry Moby. Oh my God, we're going to be rich. We're going to be rich. We're going to be rich. But when I do a somersault off the couch. And I don't tell, you know, I obviously don't relay this to Moby. I try to act really calm and cool. I don't want to come across as one of those people that's going to blab to the whole world that Moby's on OKCupid, which is basically what I'm doing now. But I don't want to come across that way. And I'm like, oh, that's cool. Yeah. That's cool. I listen to some of your music. It's really cool. But I'm basically, I'm freaking out because I am going to marry Moby. And I go home. I live in Koreatown. I just had, at this point, I had bought a small condo in Koreatown like a year and a half before I get home to Koreatown. And I'm like, oh my God, I've met Moby. I'm going to meet Moby. We're going to meet up. It's going to be so great. And I'm looking at my place in Koreatown and I'm like, holy shit. I can't have Moby over. I still have boxes everywhere. I have skyscrapers of paper lined up. There's no parking in K-Town. Down the block, there are MS-13 tags and graffiti tags from the really scary gang. Those are my neighbors, you know? And I'm like, I can't have Moby over here. He lives in the Hollywood Hills. I'm so broken. There are homeless people sleeping in the parking lot next door to my building. I can't have Moby over. And so I decide I need to clean this house. I need to prepare for Moby coming over to come visit me. And so over the next month, well, I am still emailing Moby, but I am also on this mission to prepare for the arrival of my future husband, Moby, coming over to Koreatown to come visit me. And in this month, I am doing things like reading up on Moby. I'm reading up about the Eminem beef that he had and listening to all his albums, because that's what Moby would want of a future wife, is someone who's up to date on 10-year-old gossip, right? And every friend I run into, I tell them the story. I swear them to secrecy, to the point that I've sworn about 50 people to secrecy about me meeting Moby. And everyone is super excited for me. And all my friends, it seems, have a stake in me marrying Moby. Like... Mike needs me to marry Moby so that Moby can be the executive producer of Mike's next film. My friend Paul needs me to marry Moby so that me, Moby, Paul, and his new girlfriend can go on a double date, and then Paul can seem really cool to his new girlfriend. My friend Ian, who does the tech design for my theater shows, needs me to marry Moby so that Moby can design the music for my show, and then we will for sure get an audience because we have a Grammy-nominated musician doing the music for my theater show. And my friend Jen needs me to marry Moby so that we can go to the MTV Music Awards. She would be my plus one, right? So I'm basically I'm prepping for Moby, and the messages that we're exchanging have changed actually quite dramatically. At the point that Moby reveals himself as Moby, and I know that he's Moby, they're no longer these sort of stream of conscious type exchanges. They get shorter and shorter, and I am super self-conscious. It takes me sometimes half an hour to construct four sentences in the vein of sort of emo cool, I would just sort of shut this off with my fingers, and really I'm just so super paranoid about what I'm projecting to him, and am I projecting the qualities of a good wife. And I, as I'm cleaning my home, you know how Christians have that mantra, WWJD, what would Jesus do? Like in times of crisis, they think about what would their Lord and Savior do in this moment of crisis. My new mantra becomes WWMWD. What would Moby's wife do? And I conduct myself in the vein of someone who's going to be rich in a year. I've convinced myself that in a year I will be living in the Hollywood Hills, that I will have lots of rich friends and so much money. And I realize a lot of the problems that I've been holding on to in this present moment of cleaning my home don't matter anymore. Like so many of my problems had to do with being poor and not having enough, or having bitterness and resentment to people, that it won't matter, because in a year from now I'm going to be friends with all sorts of rich people in the Hollywood Hills. It won't matter. And I just instantly drop all this baggage that I have with old people. So our emails begin to shift even more. We do talk about, well, let's meet up soon, but we always seem to be in and out of town at different times. And it's about 4 months into my earliest exchanges with Moby, and I always try to touch on something about my life, and it's gotten to the point that he doesn't actually even acknowledge what's happened that I've mentioned in my emails, whether it's my cat dying or just things I'm doing or where I am on the road. He just sends funny photos at this point, like funny photos from the internet, like of a guy with a hairy chest that's waxed with a heart on the chest, like a little dog wearing a funny sweater. And I begin to dread meeting Moby. Like, what will happen if we don't get along? I'm kind of actually enjoying the mindset that my life is in at this moment. What if I meet him and we don't even get along? Or what if we do get along, we do hit it off, we do get married, and this same sort of cold exchanging that is happening now with email happens in our home? What if I am in this beautiful parlor that I live in with him in the Hollywood Hills, and I am in an emotional crisis, and he only responds with sending photos? I wouldn't tolerate this of anybody else. I'm only tolerating it of Moby because he's rich and he has money and he has agency. And I had to think, well, if I'm in the hills with him and we get into a fight, am I gonna let him win this fight? Am I gonna let him get his way because I don't wanna move back to Koreatown with the MS-13 gang? Or am I gonna stand up for myself? Of course I'm gonna stand up for myself. And I decide that I'm gonna write Moby an email and ask him to be a little bit more connected to me. So I write him an email and I say, you know, Moby, I really appreciate that you've been sending, you know, these cute photos. I'll always look at them. But I can't help but feel like every time I send you a message like detailing things in my life that I can't even tell that you've read it. You don't seem to acknowledge it in my emails. And it would be nice if you just acknowledged some of the content in the messages I'm sending to you. And I sent it. And he never wrote back. He never wrote back after that point. And my friends were so pissed off at me. Paul was like, you have to write him back and apologize for sending that. You have to just write him one more time. Mike was like, yeah, you shouldn't have ever told him that you knew it was Moby. You should have just kept it a secret. You should have just kept it to yourself. You should have just acted like on your first date that you didn't know it was him and just carried it out. And I said, guys, no, it's not that bad. I mean, yeah, okay, so I never got to meet Moby or marry Moby, but look how clean my house is. Look how much old baggage I've dropped from my life, like all the resentments I've dropped. And I am more hopeful than I've ever felt in my entire life. In ways, I am more prepared for finding love than I was before this. And in ways, this non-meeting with Moby was sort of the perfect relationship. So I guess the moral of the story is, if you are a hoarder and have low self-esteem, you should go to Craigslist and go to the casual encounters section and look for like a blurry dick photo and just tell yourself that's Keith Richards and that he wants you in the hills and he's going to marry you and you have so much power and you'll just start cleaning your house. Anyways, I'm Christina Wong. Thank you so much.
Dicky Mo.
Thank you. I'm genuinely, I can't decide between two different things to talk about. So do people want to hear a ghost story or a story about acid?
Acid.
Okay. Fuck. That's the one Kevin said I should do. I told Kevin I was torn and he said that and I didn't want to listen to him. So, I grew up with Kevin, like, in college and stuff. Kevin Allison, who does this wonderful show. And he was with me this whole time, but doesn't know any of this stuff. And he said, well, fuck, I'd like to hear the acid stuff. I've done a lot of acid. I've done at least 400 hits of acid. And I know that because over about a four-year period... And I know that because while I was doing it, I was sort of keeping track. And I say not lightly, acid is very much a part of why I am who I am. Acid is very much a reason that my brain works the way it does. And this is the story of my bad trip that I had. So the first time I ever did acid, I bluffed myself into it. After my freshman year of college, I went to New York University, and then I came back to Tennessee, where I'm from, very small town in Tennessee, where I really only had two friends. And when I came back, they said they had discovered acid their freshman year. And they said, have you done acid, man? And I was big New York big shot, and I didn't want to admit, no, of course I haven't done acid. And so I said, yeah, acid's great. I love acid. And they said, good, pop, let's do some right now. And so I took four tabs of acid and launched into it. And that was the first time I'd ever done it. And the big thing I remember from that first trip was driving around in the mountains in Josh's old Volkswagen Bug. And there were holes in the floorboards so you could see the road. Going through, and we were listening to Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds loud, and the mercy seat is waiting over and over and over and again, and it's pouring rain, and I'm in the back, like trying to keep my feet on the beams so that I don't go through to the road, and it's pouring rain, and rain is splashing up from the road and just tripping balls, and my friend Sam is in the passenger seat with a Coke bottle, and he's going, hey guys, nothing. And over the course of the trip, he must have done it 50 times. And I'm holding on, and we're racing down these deserted roads. And the next day, Sam told me that his Coke bottle was singing Elvis songs to him. And when he was trying to get our attention so that we could see, the Coke bottle was going, shh. So that's what that was happening. And it was not raining the night before at all. And his Volkswagen did not have holes in the floorboards. So I was in. I loved acid. I after that, that was the most fun. Who's here done acid? Woo! Woo! Yeah, it's a nitrous engine through a funhouse, and I loved it. And part of that first acid trip sort of made me the way I was the rest of my acid experience, which is I was in control. Like, when something terrifying happened, I could very calmly steer away from it and go that way. You know, when I started to think dark, scary thoughts that I didn't want to think, I was very, very competent at just like, okay, I'm not going to think about that. Or walk into a weird place I'd never been before, and that corner's got a scary, well, I'm not going to go into that corner. I'm going to go that way. And I think that's because the very first trip I ever had, I was pretending I was the pro. I'm the captain of the ship, guys. Don't worry. Everybody's okay. You're with me. I'm going to weather us through this storm. And that attitude kept me through acid my whole time I did acid. And there was really good acid around. This is in the late 80s. So I could trip balls and be in public. I did acid in museums and at school and in restaurants, and I could order. And nobody knew that I was totally fucking tripping balls and that people's faces were like melting off of their skulls. But I knew it was the acid, and I was totally in control. And part of that, I think, was because I was weird and quiet all the time anyway. But I spent a weekend in Vegas with people where I did 12 hits of acid over 3 days, and nobody knew. None of my friends knew that I was on acid. I always tripped alone, always, this whole time. After I left my buddies in Tennessee and went back to New York, I tripped alone. I think because I'm a weird private person and didn't want to share stuff, and I think because I've been around people who have a bad trip and you have to rescue them. And so you spend your trip keeping your shit together and like arranging the helicopters to get the guy down out of the ravine when you should just be fucking hiking in the Alps and having a great time. And so I tripped alone, and I tripped alone a lot. I was so good at people not knowing I was on acid, I got pretty casual about using it. I accidentally once tripped with my parents for 6 hours. My parents were not hippies. My parents were Church of Christ. My friends and I in Tennessee had a system. I had an uncle with a cabin way up in the mountains, like this Evil Dead looking fucking cabin way out in the middle of nowhere. And so we would go up there and do acid and trip for days in a row. And so the system was, Josh would call, we would hit, boom, because it was a 40-minute drive up to this cabin, so that like it would start to kick in when you left the highway and get onto the dirt road, so that you start to enter Wonderland when the road gets bumpy, and it was perfect. So New Year's Eve, he says, I'm starting the car, drop. So I drop, boom, 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 boom. And I'm sitting there, and I'm waiting for Josh to pull up. And 10 minutes go by, and 30 minutes go by, and an hour goes by. And my brain is starting to get weird. And Josh calls and said, car won't start, dude. Happy New Year. So any other night, my parents would have been in bed by 9. But it's New Year's, so they're up the whole time. So I'm there tripping balls, watching Dick Clark. and realizing that I am my father, which at 20 is a big realization to make. Like in 20, when you realize, oh, everything I'm doing, I'm thinking I'm this weird punk rock avant-garde dude. I'm just my dad. I drink the same fucking beer. I walk the same. I talk the same. I hate the same commercials. You know, and that at 20 is a big realization. Back in New York, I continued doing acid a lot. I did acid, and when it was warm, I hung out in Washington Square Park or Central Park and walked around, and when it was cold, I went into the Natural History Museum or the Met, because they were both free. The Natural History Museum, for those of you who don't know, I wrote the movie Night at the Museum, which makes a lot of sense that I did a lot of acid. I had a partner writing that, so I didn't write the whole thing. But there are moments in that movie that are totally fucking happened to me, man. Like Teddy Roosevelt never spoke to me, but I know the sensation in that museum of like walking down the dark halls and sort of forgetting where you are because you're listening to, oh, wow, listen to that cool accent. Listen to what those kids are talking about. And you forget where you are. And then all of a sudden, fucking dinosaur! Fuck! Like, and you genuinely, for about half a second, think there's a really a fucking alive dinosaur right there. And in this existence, half a second is a long time to think that there's really a dinosaur right there. And so I experienced that. And I also, the dioramas, like the dioramas in Natural History Museum in that movie are very much from my acid days. Because I remember looking at the dioramas and spending tons of time and thinking, how do they know when one of them, there's so many, how do they know one of them didn't get out? And then laughing hysterically in my head at how funny it would be to go to a garden and say, how do you know one of them didn't get out? And that was the drug. So I learned a lot on acid. The two big things that changed my life from that drug were I was a really angry kid. I was a punk rock. My parents were not great to me, or at least I thought not at the time. And I was a punk rock kid in Tennessee, so I had green hair in Tennessee. So people slashed my tires, and so I was an angry, angry kid. And I took that anger with me to New York, and I cut myself, and I had pins in my skin, and I was furious. And an acid trip gave me a big realization that, like ecstasy, when you make a realization on acid, it sticks if it's true. And I realized, like, I'm not obsessed about other people. I'm walking around Delphi thinking that everybody hates me or thinking that everybody thinks I'm weird or stupid because of my accent or everybody at NYU has better clothes than me and I think everybody hates me. And I realized people don't think about people they don't know. People don't think about their coworkers. People are so wrapped up in their own brain that they're not hating you. They don't have time. They don't think about it. And that's a kind of an obvious realization to make. But without acid, I never would have made that realization. And it changed me from being a paranoid, hateful, angry person to, fine, I can just walk around. Nobody in this room is thinking about me. If I sit in the corner and keep my mouth shut, nobody gives a shit what I'm thinking, which is huge. And it changed me from being angry to being okay. And the other thing that it did, acid, was I never wrote a word until I did acid, which is just true. Like, I hated writing in high school. I never wrote funny sketches. I was in the state for a year, and I didn't write any sketches the first four shows of the state. But acid did something, and I am now a professional writer. I make a lot of money, and I love it. And thank you. And I enjoy it, and I think it has something to do with some clogs that acid washed through. And I think it comes from going to the Met and looking at paintings saying, wow, Christ looks like a boxer in that one. Hey, how you doing, St. Paul? What are you doing? Hey, let's go over to this and talk to this dragon. And like loosening up this weird sort of dialogue in my head that now is my fucking job. And that's acid. So I started using it so much that I really wasn't learning anything. I was just sort of fucking around on it. And I realized I can't do acid forever. I looked bad. I was skinny. I looked like Sid Vicious, which at the time I thought was cool, but my friends were worried about me, and I looked like I was about to drop dead because I never ate. My skin was bad. I was skinny, and I should stop. And I realized that if I was going to stop doing acid, I can't do it with having always avoided that monster in the corner. I knew that the scary idea in my head or the scary thing under the stairs, I always go, hey, I'm not going to think about that. And I know that if I'm really going to use acid as a tool to make my brain better, I have to go, I have to face this thing. I have to find out what's there, and it's probably going to be okay. But I can't have avoided a big thing my brain is saying for all of these trips. So that's what I did. My big fear from doing this was two friends really ever for the first like 17 years of my life, these two guys who did acid with me, and one of them acid totally fucked up. One of them was probably a better writer than I was, at least when I was 18, and acid changed him between freshman year and sophomore year, the time I saw him those two summers. I came back and he was a different guy, and I don't mean in an esoteric way. I mean, he couldn't put words together. He was a different guy. And he tried to explain to me once that he had a bad trip, that he was making out with some girl, and suddenly she was a mannequin. And then suddenly he was on the floor making out with this mannequin in a room full of people, and they were all watching him. And he said at the time, I don't know what really happened. I don't know, was it a girl that I freaked out with? Was I really making love with a mannequin? I don't know. But he lost something. He would say, I hit the fucking brake. like when he wasn't on drugs, he would just sort of say that sometimes. So it wasn't like an esoteric, you're slightly a different guy. Like acid did something damaging to Sam. And so there's that. Part of my brain was like, is that going to happen to me? But I needed to do it. If I was going to stop doing this drug, I needed to make this trip. I needed to go there. So I did. I took 5 hits of acid and I went the trip. Geographically, I walked from where I lived on 10th in New York down to Washington Square Park, all the way up Fifth Avenue to Central Park, through Central Park, down Broadway, back to 10th, which is about 20 miles. I walked this whole trip. It wasn't monsters that got me. Like, it's hard to describe, but the fear that happened, and I don't know how it began, was it's not that I couldn't remember who I was, and it's not that I didn't know who I was. It's that I knew who I was, and who I was nobody. I was nothing. And so I was walking around thinking, well, who are you? Who are you? Who are you? Well, I've got pink hair. Yeah, that's not you. That's bullshit. You're doing that to impress people so that you can avoid actual conversations. Who are you? Well, I'm an actor at NYU. You don't want to be an actor. You don't take it seriously. You're making fun in your head of all these people who want to be actors. Who are you? I'm from Tennessee. You don't want to be from Tennessee. You don't take pride in that. Who are you? And it was peeling an onion, and there was nothing in the middle of the onion. I knew all the things that I wasn't. I knew all the things I was pretending to be. There was nothing else. There was nothing in the middle. And it wasn't a esoteric, sitting on a psychiatrist's couch exploration of that. I was bawling and with snot running down my face and terrified because I didn't know where to go. I didn't know how to go back to 10th Street because, like, I didn't know who I was. Like, very real, I wasn't anybody. It's terrifying. Thanks, Kevin, for suggesting this one. Thanks, guys. It's a really good ghost story, you guys. So I really genuinely didn't know who I was. And a couple of things came out of it. I shaved my head for the first time and never dyed my hair again. That's nothing. I had a Walkman that I used to listen to all the time, and I threw it into the reservoir in New York, Central Park, because I realized I was avoiding people by listening to music instead of really being where I was. I used to, at the end of state shows, there would be parties, and I never went. I would go away because I was scared. I didn't want to be there. This is my phone now. It doesn't play music. It doesn't have videos because I want to be here. And this was 20 years ago, but it was because it taught me that I was avoiding just being where I was and being myself to the extent that I wasn't anybody. And I would say in a very real way, who I am now started that night that I realized, like, well, I'm nobody yet. But I have to start to be something. I have to really start to listen to people and be honest with people and open people and be something, even if it means I suck. You know, like, I have to be that. Even if it means I have to, like, let people know what I'm good at and what I'm bad at. And that's really when I began to realize, well, I'm going to be a writer. Even if I'm not good at it, that's the one thing that I'm kind of doing, and I'm going to do it. I kind of opened up to people, and I'm still not the most open person in the world. As anybody who knows me knows, I'm still very, very quiet and very, very shy. But I'm a writer.
You're somebody.
Well, that's not what I mean. I everybody is somebody. But I'm a writer. I know that. I don't have many friends, but the friends I have know everything there is to know about me, and I trust them and I love them, which I didn't have before. And I mean, I'm doing great. Like, I'm not, like, living on the street. I have a big, giant house from all these stupid movies. But it really made me who I am by washing the slate clean and making me realize that I, at that point, really was a bunch of bullshit that I was telling people. And that's a good thing to learn at such an early age. And the other weird thing that I think about a lot is, you know, Sam took some weird acid and he never came back. Me too. Like, there was another guy that took those 5 tabs, and that guy's gone.
That is all for this week, folks. This is Connor Youngblood behind me now. And again, that was Ben Grant with that remarkable story we just heard told at the Nerdmelt Theater in Los Angeles. We are there every fourth Thursday. We are at the Pit in New York City every fourth Thursday. And our touring show's coming up. Atlanta, we are in your city on November 6th. And we have workshops the next day. You can find out about the workshops through villagecomedy.com. The workshops are, I'm doing one in sketch comedy and one in storytelling. Albuquerque, we are at Pornotopia on November 13th. But I'll also be there next couple of days teaching kink workshops at Albuquerque Pornotopia. Minneapolis, we are in town on the 4th of December. The pitch deadline for that is pretty much right now. So if you want to be included in the Minneapolis show, get your pitches to us. Write to me at kevin@risk-show.com or just go to the submissions page at risk-show.com. The theme for that Minneapolis show is dangerous. And then on the 12th of December, we are in Seattle. The theme that night is fucked up. The pitch deadline is about mid-November for that. So also, if you live in Seattle, pitch us your stories, your fucked up stories. And don't forget that we teach storytelling as well. Not just storytelling in this wild, uncensored realm like Risk, but also more conservative and practical stories, for example, that you might tell in the business world. At thestorystudio.org, we do one-on-one training, we do corporate training for staffs, we do workshops in New York and Los Angeles for creative people, people who want to get up on stage and share stories. There's a lot to learn. If you go to thestorystudio.org, there's our online class that you can take in your own time. Just get on over there and become a part of all of this at thestorystudio.org. Finally, Risk is a proud member of the Maximum Fun Network of Podcasts. And just like all the other podcasts at Maximum Fun, we are listener supported. We very much rely on the help of the people who love what we do. So go there. Go to MaximumFun.org/donate and make a one-time contribution or become a member. And be sure to earmark your contribution for Risk. Folks, here is a neither stoned nor drunk me saying, today's the day. Take a risk.
Dick.